Bandwidth for the Weird Things podcast provided by WiredTree. For sites of any size and world-class customer service, head on over to WiredTree.com.
Welcome to After Things. I'm Andrew Main, joined by Brian Brushwood.
He say you, Braid Runner. That's not racist. I'm quoting verbatim.
Yeah, totally different. And speaking of racist things that aren't racist, Justin Robert Young.
Hey, I disavow Brian for saying that racist thing.
So just a heads up for those of you who didn't get the warning, this is going to be a very, very spoil-filled episode as we talk about the movie Blade Runner 2049. If you've not seen this movie, far be it for me to tell you what to do with your life. Go see Blade Runner.
The bio cow in the chat says, no spoilers, please. Yeah, not going to happen.
Sorry.
Bad news.
Sorry. So, gentlemen,
it's a good
Blade
movie,
Runner
guys.
2049 came out this weekend, and it didn't. It had, we'll call it, a tepid box office response, but the critical reaction to it has been quite good, exceptional. It's directed by Denis Villeneuve, who did Sicario and Arrival and a few other, you know, notable movies. He is one of my favorite directors. After Arrival and Sicario, I'm like, I'm more excited to, you know, see what this guy's doing next. He's been attached to doing Dune, et cetera, whatnot. So we've all seen it. What are our reactions?
Can we start by evaluating, setting a baseline on how we feel about the first movie? Because, spoiler alert, I think this second movie is better by just about any measure I could put to it than the first movie. I think, except for groundbreaking. The first movie was groundbreaking, and the second one very much follows in the same vein. But in terms of the electricity of the plot flow of the... the pacing, even though it was a very, very long, very, very relaxed a languid journey, this meditation on what it means to be a creative artifact in an increasingly post-human civilization. I thought all of it just kept me alive and interested the entire
Gamley
way
says,
through.
You're way off your baseline, Brian.
Yeah. Fair enough. I am fond of the world of the first one, but the first one, I fell asleep during a lot.
Was that you like, said by any metric that you compared the two, what were some of the metrics you were comparing
pacing, quality of special effects, details on the world created around it. I loved the fact that in this universe, Pan Am still exists. And the Soviet Union, the USSR, still exists and is spending money on propaganda.
Atari is finally back again.
And they're spending money for propaganda in a version of Los Angeles in which it snows. I loved the fact that that this world of orphan children's reclaiming valuable minerals out of circuit boards, they don't even have to explain it. I think that's my favorite thing about this movie from beginning to end is how little they felt the need to explain, because it's like, yeah, we get it. You know, even the bizarre three-way between an artificially intelligent holo projection, a hired calling girl, and a robot man detective, I bought all of it and I loved all of it. It was just wonderful. I loved it.
So let's just talk about the first one first. What, because you know, there've been many versions of the original Blade Runner.
Yeah.
Right, and that is the discussion. Should you see it with narration, without narration? And I have a very, very, very strong opinion about that. What was the first version you saw, Brian?
It would have been whatever was on, whatever was on HBO, so probably the theatrical version. And then in the early days of DVDs, Blade Runner was sort of the quintessential show it off to your friends. Look at how good this looks. And, you know, that's real widescreen, even though it's standard definition because it's the late 90s. Whenever I watched it in those days when I knew I was supposed to love it, I loved the visuals. The music was dreamlike and all that stuff. fell asleep every time. And I watched all the different versions and fell asleep to all of them. This one was able to hit that same flavor, but with an electricity that just kept me riveted the entire time.
Well, you know, I made a realization the day that I saw 2049, which was that when I was watching the original with narration, that I had never seen the with narration version. I had always watched the director's cut because, you know, I ain't no kid. I deserve the director's cut.
I ain't no 9-year-old mayor of a small town outpost in the wastelands.
Yeah, and I can understand the criticism with the narration in that it does sound like Harrison Ford was held hostage and not allowed to leave the room until he recorded it. But I will say that it provided a tremendously better experience. I was like you, Brian, where like I had never really been able to make it through without kind of fading out of interest to it or falling asleep or something previous to that. And this, you know, the narration kind of glued a lot of stuff together for me and really leaned into what turns out to be the lasting legacy of the original movie, which is the universe that is built and the themes that are within it. You know, obviously there's a little bit more. The first one deals with the idea of replicants and humans in, listen, Harrison Ford drops the N-word in the narration. And so you can get a sense of where in a story that is closer to the civil rights struggle in America, where the general messaging was about the idea of, you know, the right people and the others and how they need to be dealt with in the great way that science fiction allows us to by removing, you know, these things so we can dissect them on another level. 2049 deals with so many different you know, takes all those ideas and to me extrapolates them. I always have a hard time saying it's better because you don't get to this without that. And it's like saying that, you know, Dr. Dre is better than Run DMC or DJ Kool Herc. And it's like, yeah, I would rather listen to Dr. Dre than I would listen to those. But you don't get to there without that. So it's hard for me to parse.
I understand. But I can certainly qualify if you say as a movie, which has like I describe like Blade Runner and say, you know, I say it's like, it's 78% to 80% the original perfect, and it's the 20% is what keeps it from being a movie that puts it over the top. Because it was a troubled production. It was amazing this movie even got made. It was a troubled production, but it's always been one of my favorite movies because despite the flaws, I absolutely adore it and love it. And that end scene with Roy Batty, whatever, and it really is this wonderful exploration of what does it mean to have a soul? And you know, we start off with this movie at the very beginning, you know, of the first Blade Runner, the Voight Kampff test, which is, this is the test of how we tell if you're a replicant. And you realize it's not to tell if you've got a soul or not. It's just sort of more to tell how your responses are. And you know, it's interesting going through all the iterations of the script, the first version, which was with, you know, Hampton Fancher wrote, and then it was David Peoples was brought in by Ridley Scott to rewrite it because Fancher was getting kind of stressed out. This one, they brought Hampton Fancher back to write the script, and then they had Michael Green come in and sort of kind of change things up. And so it's not one person's story, but largely a lot of the themes that Hampton Fancher had in the first one were in this. Like, I love this opening with the farmhouse, the scene with the David Bautista scene, the sapper scene. That was actually in the original Blade Runner. That was how they were going to open up the original one. Deckard shows up at this farmhouse, whatever kind of thing in that. And I love that they kind of got to bring back a lot of these themes. I describe the first one as, you know, what's it mean to have a soul, you know, and who has a soul and who doesn't? Just because you're human, do you have this? And then we see that, you know, the Roy Batty character does. This one I loved because it was about love. It was the love between a parent and a child, the love between a god and his minions and the minions and their god, the love between two people who it's never going to work out for. You know, it was such an amazing exploration of that.
And specifically when it comes to the god thing, ultimately the story of the first Blade Runner is, you know, man meets God, man kills God, right? That's the Roy Batty story. And then his decisions afterward, looking at all the sacrifice and carnage for which surrounds him, he makes the decision to save Deckard's life. this is a different story where, again, we are dealing with, you know, man and God. But I don't know. I've read a lot of response to this. There was a lot of response that I read that was like, I didn't know what Jared Leto was doing. I thought Jared Leto's character motivations were fairly clear to me.
Oh,
but
yeah,
I don't know whether or not that was maybe I took a wrong turn at Albuquerque.
No, I loved it. But again, I'm one of these wacko fans that thinks Rick is the hero of Rick and Morty, Rick Sanchez.
Well, and so just so we can hash it out, I mean, I guess his character motivation was that he craved perfection. He wanted to create the ultimate replacement for humankind, and anything less than perfection was not okay.
Well, he wanted to create
a new species.
Right, self-replicate, right? Yeah.
He was, because he talked about the fact that, like, we've colonized 9 planets. A child can count up that high on their hands. We should be trillions and trillions and trillions. And he saw his manifest destiny of populating the entire galaxy with whatever he could. And that's what I love about this story, is the bigger story is he isn't even on Earth. And this is just a small part of the story where we're dealing with the aftermath. I loved, you know, that idea that, you know, we're seeing the smallest part of that story in a sense. And then I loved like they kidnap Decker, like, where we're going, oh, we're going home. And I'm like, here's my hope. This movie is not really performing that well. I think the property is amazing, and I would love to see a TV series set in this universe.
110%. I'd absolutely love it. I mean, to me, the motivation of Jared Leto is the same as an engineer trying to figure out how do we scale Twitter from hundreds of users to millions of users simultaneously. He is looking for an engineering fix for which eludes him, and yet his predecessor, Tyrell, from the first movie, figured out, apparently, and was killed before he could take it any further, as we realize that he created Rachel specially to be able to breed. He cracked the code that Jared Leto is not able to, but he needs to be able, if he wants, again, to scale. He needs to scale replicants.
Did I miss, there's every possibility I missed something here, but one of the things I liked from the way I watched it was, you know, most of the talk about whether or not Deckard was a replicant all came, you know, years after the original. It was more implied in the director's cut and the final cut and the final edition and so on. In this movie, though, they never talk about it one way or the other, do they? And is it possible that Deckard is there? I watched this whole movie assuming Deckard was a replicant, and that's why he was able to live in the radioactive wastes of Las Vegas alone with all the whiskey he could want. But I wonder if there's an alternate version of looking at it where you assume he's human and that the child was a human replicant hybrid. Is there any room for that, or did I miss something?
No, I mean, the movie, I think, makes a lot of leeway for both things to be possible.
Yeah, I guess it was fun for me to watch the whole movie. Yeah. Just, he's clearly a replicant. This is a story of a new species being born. But then only the next day I was like, oh, wait.
They really don't prove it.
Right. Anyway. What if he was a human?
He can't break out of the car when they're in the water.
He doesn't have super strength.
Well, we don't know. He doesn't fight K.
We don't see. Yeah, correct.
You know, if he's a replicant, he might be an older model where he couldn't be allowed to break out of restraints or something. Or
right.
Wallace is able to control him somehow.
Sorry. Go ahead.
And I think this is why I think he is a replicant, is that Wallace very clearly says, well, what if we designed you to fall in love with Rachel? Or what if Tyrell designed you to fall in love with Rachel?
Well, right. and that brings in the answer is there is no answer. There's no definitive answer to that, because Fancher never liked the idea that that Deckard was the replicant. Ridley Scott liked the idea that he was. Villeneuve has not explicitly said either way, as far as I know, hey, you know that he is or he isn't. You know, there is that implication that he could be. There is the suspicion of that, but canonically, this is not canon. This Do Androids Dream of Electricity has nothing really to do with this movie at this point. To be clear, so it is this sort of it's this, and it's being, I think it's going to be continuously left open until there's a more interesting answer. And you know, I think that I don't, I just I love the universe they built. I love the movie is beautiful and gorgeous movie. So well done. The characters are so paced, but I'm dying to know, like, what is Offworld like, where we've needed to invent this entire clone robot slave force of army, you know, people to fight to conquer these colonies, you know, like, yeah. What's going on out there?
Can I just shine a spotlight on one scene that might have been so unbelievably done if it weren't handled so, so well? That scene of the gunfight with Kay and Deckard in Las Vegas with holograms of Elvis on in the background, what a testament to the power that good sound design can do. By leaving things hollow and empty and hearing the occasional glitch and largely silence and footsteps and gunfire, that was a positively electric set piece. I loved it. I loved it. I loved it.
Yeah, it was so well done in just every single frame. The only things that felt digital are the things that were supposed to, the holograms, the projections. Everything else felt gritty and real. That opening scene, the idea of, instead of using night, of using just cloudy, overcast skies, was a wonderful choice. It was great. Now, the people, you know, the comment, why not use robots instead of replicants? Well, part of the idea of the replicant is the idea that they're not really robots. They're clones.
Yeah.
They're just better versions of us. And that brings up the moral question. You have the idea of, like, we call them this thing, but they are us. They are human, you know, but if, as long as we pretend, and that gets back to the whole idea of racism and slavery, when you're like, no, they're another thing. They're a subspecies. They're not really this thing. And it's like, okay. And how did they define? I loved in this movie, like, well, yeah, you're not human. You don't have a soul because you weren't born. And like, oh, I wasn't born, so I don't have a soul. That's how it works. Yeah. I came out of a Ziploc bag, and that kept the soul from getting in me.
Well, and the Wallace character is like, listen, humanity lost its taste for slavery, so I'm selling them, you know, oh, this isn't slavery. This is replicants. It's a totally different thing. They're totally different. We have no qualms about sending them to die or you know, giving them a second-class citizen life. And if anything, part of this story, the first hour of this story kind of gives you a little bit of that, like a little bit of the, like, F off skin job kind of comments. And then it really becomes a story about, you know, the battles beyond that, about, you know, how does Kay, a replicant, look at his relationship with Joy, right? Like what does he think? I mean, obviously he is in love with Joy, but like, what should his expectations be? Is he an idiot for falling in love with what is effectively an AI designed to make him fall in love with him?
What else could he do? I mean, it's like there's not a lot on the menu very clearly from his social standing, being a skin job that's looked down. It's not like he can go down and seduce anyone at the bar. Instead, he takes love where he can find it, and it is a strange kind of love. You know, the Joy plot is really interesting, because I could see very easily just stripping that away and having a still complete and whole movie. And there are complications to it being in there, in that I can't directly point to why it belongs or what it did to further the main narrative. However, atmospherically and as far as understanding Kay, I loved every second of that very strange, complicated relationship that they had.
Yeah. I thought it was amazing. It was probably my favorite and most unexpected part of the movie was not only her relationship, but also just Ana de Armas, who played her. I thought she was awesome. I thought she was great.
You think at first, you think it's like, it's kind of quirky and weird. He's got a robot, you know, lots of elements of her in there. And, you know, I don't know how intentional or not, or a constant they were of that, but. And the same sort of thing we've seen of, you know, the AI using the other person as the surrogate, whatever. But hey, whatever. Joy was the unexpected delight, you know, because anybody you feel for the most was her and the AI, and the idea that, like, and we don't know, was it real or not? But that was what I loved about that, was we don't know. We don't know if her love for him is real, but to him it felt real, and he doesn't know if he's real. And that was like, that's so smart. So smart.
Well, and how painful after his version of her is totally lost forever, you know, that he encounters the completely vacuous, dead-eyed advertisement version, the walking embodiment of you know, the only meaningful relationships he's had. That was all powerful stuff. I liked it quite a bit.
All right, here, I got two hot takes that I want your guys' opinions on that I've read over the weekend. Hot take number one, thank God we made a movie that has all the characters be, all the female characters be, you know, vapid sex objects.
Wait, you can't do that. The chief, Robin Wright. Was amazing. That invalidates the hot take. Robin Wright was amazing, hard-nosed, grizzled, semi-corrupt police chief. I mean, she was great.
Yeah, and Love was... I don't think anybody was really lusting after Love there. She was scary.
She was...
I thought she was awesome. I thought she was great.
She was wonderful, but she was not.
She was threatening. Yeah. She was scary.
She was not a sex object. You know, she was just this badass villain that it's like, yeah, we had two really amazingly strong female characters in there that were like not sex objects. You know, they were not objects of desire. They were objects of authority or fear.
I agree, which is why I used a weird voice for the hot take. But yeah, I'm totally with you guys. I thought that the female characters, and granted, panel of three men talking about how, well, female characters were great and diverse, right? But there's definitely I thought that the motivations that I at least read into all the characters and the presentations of all the characters to me belayed a difference in motivations. And
let me
and
call this a panel of three men, none of which were saying like, oh, she was a sex object? That I was supposed to think that her, she was a sex object? I'm sorry, I didn't. I guess I failed. I mean, that's,
yeah.
You know, if you're telling me, oh, they're all, no, I looked at this other woman. Like, maybe somebody else says, oh, she's attractive. Therefore, no, she was attractive, but I was intimidated and scared by her, you know?
Yeah. What was the other hot take?
Well, I want that to be the last thing, because it's kind of an all-encompassing hot take that's been kind of going around. Did anybody have anything else that they wanted to get out with the?
Yeah, the music, especially the parts that were totally discordant, that were unsettling with the sound effects. Loved all of that. Loved the world building. We talked about the orphans doing the stuff. I thought the three-way sex scene was amazing and clumsy and very believable and real. How great was it that they didn't kill off Deckard? That was adorable. Like the moment old Han Solo shows up, I'm like, well, I wonder what happens here. And instead, it totally subverted expectations, and I was really happy for that.
Just like, hey, listen, I'll give you the same deal I gave JJ. I'll be in your movie, but you have to kill me at the end. And he's like, we don't really want to kill you. All right, I'll bargain with you. But I'll do your movie, and I won't die. But I'm gonna wear what I literally woke up in.
Fine. I loved everybody's sort of journey where Kay kind of reached the end of his sort of his purpose or whatever he's supposed to do. He lost, you know, joy was gone, you know, and that. And then it's kind of like, well, what now for him? You know, and that ending was sad. And also I'm gonna say, like, I think Ryan Gosling's like a fine actor. Like, I saw the Avatar font sketch he did for SNL. I thought was hilarious and probably one of my favorite things he's ever done in. But he's always felt a little bit off to me, and I thought this was a perfect role for him. You know, I thought that there was, you know, I don't know if it's because he's Canadian or what, but there's just something about him that's never quite fully felt human. So this was a really, really great role for him, I thought. And I thought it was, you know, just an amazing take.
Yeah.
Canadians are people. I didn't mean that.
What else was there? Where else did we visit?
Edward James Olmos coming back. Gaff, that great line, like, we like to be alone, which is why we work well together. Oh, my God. Just.
Yeah.
What about the surprise cameo from Sean Young?
As young Sean Young? Or did she show up as old?
So uh, young. yeah, there are reports that they did film stuff with Sean Young very secretly. And so...
Well, her name's in the credits.
Right.
And what's funny is I just assumed it was a Grand Moff Tarkin thing up until I saw her
name
in the credits.
They had an actor stand-in, and then they took all the original footage. And
yeah, except for, by the way, how did that look like damn near photorealistic and Grand Moff Tarkin looked like a Snapchat filter?
Yeah.
And they still, like...
They haven't
talked
about it.
Or the Princess Leia, you know? Like, they still like, oh, look at these effects we did. Like, yeah, those horrible things that brought an already bad movie to a grinding halt, says Evil Andrew. Real Andrew loves it.
But
that was realistic. Was so fooled, like, wow, he's still alive! Yay!
I gasped when I saw the silhouette, because they spend the whole movie being like, oh yeah, Rachel died. Which, like, if you know a little bit about Sean Young's history after Blade Runner, was not a great one in Hollywood. And so you think, okay, so they're just like definitely just gonna kill her off, and they're just gonna keep saying that she died and. She died, everybody. So,
and then when she shows up,
it's a good,
it's a
look
dramatic
of her.
Scene, and it's like, yeah, the moment you see the silhouette and you see those
the
iconic
big shoulder pads, that was a great surprise and also another good subversion of my expectations of thinking. The other thing, I think that's something that this movie is really good at is like controlling what you're thinking and then shocking you. Like, for most of the movie, I was like, okay, just like, yes, Ryan Gosling's going to be the son. And then it's revealed that he's not, because obviously he's not the Deckard's son. He's a police officer. There's no way he would be organic.
Oh, no. This is the brilliance of the blackout, is that the blackout makes all of a sudden any of that stuff is on the table. You're able to point to anything and wave your hand and say, which, by the way, that is a phenomenon that's going to happen in our lifetime. It's going to be the 9/11 of our baby pictures. And it's going to be really you could tell. That's what I loved, is that all the characters in this world, they radiated real pain from the blackout of their missing memories that they no longer had, and only paper survived and all that. I thought that was really cool.
But my whole thinking of, like, obviously he wasn't the son was because, you know, he was a replicant that was made for the police. The police aren't buying baby replicants. Replicants don't really age. They, you know, come out fully aged, right?
Well, but they indicated that the blackout shook everything up in a way where somebody would be like, yeah, no, I'm a replicant. I don't remember much after the blackout. You're
But if he was purpose-built, there wouldn't have been any history in the first place anyway.
We don't, right? We could... You could write yourself anything you want. I want to point out, I loved the cinematography. Roger Deakins did an amazing job, and they did a wonderful way of taking cues from the first one, but saying this is its own film. And one of the things I loved was in Wallace's chamber, which you could see, you know, remember when Tyrell, you met the Tyrell office, and remember, like, they had the shimmering in the background? And if you watched the extensive behind the scenes for the first Blade Runner, which you can get now if you get the... like $10 whatever on iTunes, you know, which has like 3.5 hours of behind the scenes. They talk about how Ridley Scott says, oh, I want this to shimmer like water or whatever in the background. I'm like, well, there's no water on the set. He's like, it doesn't matter. This is what I want. And they made that effect, and it was a beautiful effect because it created this image of just ostentatious wealth and whatever and power. And they brought that back in for Wallace's, but this time they did put a pool of water there, but they had that same shimmer. They did a lot of these little subtleties there and just plussed it.
Yeah, I didn't mind at all the constant flip-flopping between light and shadow the entire movie long. It just felt to me dynamic. It felt like there was a living world around them. And every time, you know, I'm sure that they had built into every set piece some reason for there to be a shadow to go over. But to me, it just read as so much traffic happening all around them at all times.
Well, that was kind of like, yeah, Scott would just do it and say it will work. And it would, even though you didn't really know where it was coming from. Deakins and Villeneuve were just like, everything was motivated. But it worked. It was beautiful. And just, you know, you have to take conventions, like you pointed out, like, you know, the lounge shootout kind of thing, and the way that we've seen those things 1,000 times, but this was so fun and sort of different. I just love this movie. I really, really people of Hollywood. Let's get a TV series. Let's do a cable or a streaming series set in this universe. We'll call it Off-World. We can deal with the off-world side of it and the implication of replicants, things like this. It is an amazing, amazing property. and you know, do it Fargo. Like each series, each season could be its own.
Just tell its own story.
Yeah, yeah. Just an anthology from the world. Like I would watch a whole season in that orphanage. I'd watch a whole season on Off Planet. I'd watch a whole season on the East Coast. You know,
I guess that's the thing I think is so amazing about this movie is that every little place that we stop is so it's so dense. Every frame, you know. There's just like the characters mean something. The world means something. We just want to spend more time. And that is in a movie that I think if there is a criticism, although, you know, there's certainly plenty of ways to say that this it deserves to be there, is that it is long. I think we can all agree that if Denis Villeneuve does Dune, it's going to be 7 hours long. Right?
Yes.
And I think that. And that certainly is a criticism, but it's an artistic one and not a commercial one. Making it that long was a commercial choice. That was not a commercial choice, and this movie may be facing some of the problems of that. But I'm glad we got this version of it, and it's unfortunate that making that artistic choice is why it's sometimes hard to have nice things, because, you know, it becomes this issue. Now, one of the things that I thought was, you know, you watch the original Blade Runner, and then you drive around L.A. and Burbank, and you're like, man, it doesn't really look like it. But then when you go to, if you take the idea of an exploding metropolis happening so quickly, you go visit Shanghai or Beijing, and you go through miles and miles of 40-story apartment blocks and things like that. And you're like, man, this kind of like, you know, Blade Runner happened, you know, we didn't have the flying cars yet, but we're surprisingly getting close to that. But visually, I mean, it's just you sometimes if you watch like on Apple TV, some of those city landscapes, it's like, yeah, this feels like the world that, you know, Ridley Scott saw.
I adored some of the attention to detail. For example, Kay's fingers were constantly filthy. Everything he touched was filthy, filthy. The car barely worked. It outdid any other instance of a lived in universe that I could think of at the moment. It felt so very believable.
There was a criticism like, oh, Vader is great, except for all the product placement. That's like complaining about a sports movie and saying there was too much football.
Well,
yeah, I mean, come on. That's the point. Half of the rad part about the original is, you know, all these fake products mixed with real products.
What's funny is I adored seeing Pan Am and CCCP, you know, USSR advertisements. But ever since watching the Red Letter Media excoriation of Sony Studios, for specifically putting Sony stuff in there, the Sony stuff did pop just a little bit more than I would have preferred, all things being equal. But yeah. I'm not going to complain.
For what? Like for this?
Yeah. Because like in the Ghostbusters review, the Plinkett review, he spells out all the ways that Sony is the worst offender about unnecessarily clumsy tie-ins with commercial products and all their movies, and he spells it all out through the Ghostbuster stuff. It heightened my radar specifically for the word Sony, and this being a Sony Pictures release, and then every time I saw the word Sony, I was like, all right, I'm gonna look beyond that.
Yeah, curious. I mean, I wonder how much that happened, because as Warner Brothers was Sony, was Alcon, and I don't, again, I don't know more or less what there was, but yeah, so, you know.
All right, you guys ready for this second hot take?
Yeah.
Yeah. Uh-oh. Second,
oh, by the way, I did love that the car was a Peugeot. I thought that was great. Yeah. I loved all the dated branding on everything.
Second hot take comes from Mark Millar. Mark Millar, the writer of Kick-Ass and just made a big deal with Netflix for a bunch of his properties. I'm just going to read straight from his post on his website. Gosling or Kay is as real as his AI girlfriend from earlier in the movie. He's only in the story as fake memories of Deckard's, and all of his scenes are fake memories. Why? Because the movie left us wondering if Deckard is real in all the ways of almost giving him that origami unicorn and letting him know that his unicorn dreams were all pre-programmed. The debate was always whether Deckard was a replicant or whether he was human, and this movie answers that question. This was secretly the entire point of it. even though it is superficial, it superficially seemed like Gosling was the protagonist. The horse was a fake memory put inside Gosling's head, a visual relative to the unicorn from the first movie, to bring him to Deckard. But the whole thing, including Gosling's existence, was a fake memory that was sent to Deckard to bring him to his daughter after years of estrangement. Nothing that this director does is accidental, and nothing is wasted. The AI girlfriend earlier with the snowflakes falling on her wrist, replicated by Gosling later in the movie when he was realized that he was never real, is there to hammer home this point. Like Fight Club, he existed nowhere else but behind the beyond the mind of another character in the movie, and every event prior to Deckard coming into the picture was fake, hinted at by Gosling's boss, too, when she says that he has no soul and he pauses for a second, almost in recognition. The final clue, though, is his name. He was called Kay and later Joe. His name is therefore Joe Kay, or Joke. He was never real, and the girl even talks about leaving these little clues where she makes the fake memories. I knew the ending was alerting me to something when it bore a hole in my brain last night, and this is it. This is why the snowstorm was happening in the background. This was our clue. The question about whether Deckard is human or not is thus answered. He's not, and she's sending him these fake memories as remotely as we saw her do. This was also the reason why she was working on a memory with Snow when Deckard came to come see her.
I hate takes like these beyond measure. When you get to the place of and combine these words and it's an anagram for falsehood.
And so we're going to plant a memory of Wallace by himself with his replicants talking about this. We're going to plant these memories of Joe alone with somebody else, because that's how we all have these memories. I have memories of you guys, you know, when I'm not there, you know, just like the Super Friends when they, you know, have the little view monitor where you're like, where's the camera placed to get away? That's the dumbest take I've heard, because it just, where's the logic? Where's the film logic? Hampton Fancher would be surprised to find out that this was the plan all along, because he didn't know that. But the whole idea that, like, okay, so who's witnessing this? Who has the memories of Wallace and all the stuff when Harrison Ford's not around? It makes no sense at all.
I'm just bringing you guys the hot takes.
I agree. It's too precious. It's too precious by half, and I don't like it. I don't care for
now,
it.
Well, again, the point is like, how do you have a memory of other people when you're not there? And the idea is that the snow thing is like, yeah, he has that memory of snow because she likes snow or whatever kind of thing, and he has this memory, and it misses it entirely, because it's like, the love between Kay and Joy was real, and that was the thing that Joy had. So again, if Bryce says, I think it's valid. If it's a valid,
speak up, Bryce.
Yeah,
I think people are allowed to have this opinion.
Explain to me why the idea that he's implanted with memories of other people and that makes it real, or that's what it is.
I think his opinion is allowed to exist.
No, what?
I think he's allowed to.
And we're allowed to take
from Bryce
why how he ignores all the things structurally. I'm a big Miller fan. Let me make that point. I'm a big fan of his. But it's one of these things like, okay, then it doesn't make any logical. He's like, I found the logic in this.
Here's a counterexample of where I do like this theory. It all kind of boils down to Occam's razor. I liked spoilers for Breaking Bad. If you haven't watched Breaking Bad, we're going to talk about the ending of it right here. The theory, even though it was expressly rejected overtly by Vince Gilligan, the theory was that it makes more sense to have Walter White die in the cold outside of this bar with cancer, then the next two episodes make sense in him becoming a super intelligent MacGyver genius, putting together a Rube Goldberg thing, swooping in, saving Jesse, killing everyone, and dying poetically next to his precious meth. Like, in that case, having an alternate theory, Occam's razor skewed in favor of it. Likewise, you know, the Blade Runner stuff, depending on which edit you watched, Occam's razor skewed in favor of like, oh, this would make more sense if Deckard was a replicant. All this does is add chaos that is unnecessary and doesn't help simplify anything.
And I would say to the Breaking Bad, which I didn't finish, by the way, now I don't have to, that can be a dream, your dying dream, where you go all around and you see these other things. When you're talking about memories, like, yeah, I remember the memory when Wallace was alone talking to this. I remember my memory when Kay was talking to the robot uprising. Wait, why would I have those memories?
Right.
You know, that would be like, oh, okay, that just seems...
It's a bit like Saving Private Ryan when old Matt Damon comes up and flashes back to not his memory for a situation he wasn't there for to tell his story.
At least we can have confabulation to explain that.
You know, I the one thing that I can say here, and I don't think that Millar in any way has nailed down anything, although I do appreciate that there is a movie in which we can have these kinds of conversations. I do like the idea that I keep forgetting her name. Dr. What's her butt?
Love?
The one who's the daughter at the end.
Oh.
Stellene.
Yeah, Dr. Stellene. That there are these memories inside Kay that might be there to bring her father back or something like that. She is in some way manipulating things through memories because that is, in its own way, godlike. You know, she is.
Yeah, no, she broke the rules. You're not supposed to put real memories in there. She broke the rules so she could put some of her out. So she broke the rules. And where did these clues end up in? A cop.
Yeah,
that was a great bit of dual reality storytelling, by the way, when he goes to her to verify and she's like, no, this is definitely a real memory. And, you know, we interpret her tears as being touched by the authenticity of his memory, not realizing that, you know, these are her tears about her duplicity of breaking the rules and putting her actual memory into him. That was
pretty satisfying. Can I say one thing that did actually really piss me off about the movie and I think really should reconsider everything that we've said? It brought me totally out of the movie. It's right up front. But there, of all the science fiction that we saw, replicants, off-world, you know, these massive corporations, the Soviet Union still existing, the idea that Ryan Gosling could, you know, weighs 105 pounds soaking wet, could in any way beat WWE World Champion Batista in a fist fight totally brought me out of the movie. It's totally unrealistic. 1 out of 10. Blade Runner 2049 sucks.
Can I confess something? I did not know Dave Bautista was in it. I didn't see his name till the credits at the end and did not recognize him when I was looking at his face. That is the first time that I felt like Dave Bautista is a real actor. When I'll tell you what.
Better every time.
Yeah.
More than Guardians?
In all seriousness, he's making himself quite a little character actor, man. He is. I'm very, very impressed by Dave Bautista's work whenever I see him.
Yeah, agreed.
Yeah. I'm ready for, hey, let's do his backstory in our Blade Runner, you know, anthology series.
Oh, I could get so into that.
Well, they gave him a backstory in one of those prequel videos.
Oh, did they?
What I love.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was a little bit too Shane. There's what I love, like some of the details, like when Gosling is, they're looking, going the furnace thing or whatever kind of thing. He goes into the bowels of that, you know, when he finds the horse. We don't realize what structure we're in, and it looks rounded like it's a massive spaceship. You know, I mean, there's just so many little details and stuff there I loved of like there's a bigger universe there, and I loved that. I just loved that, like, there are these, you know, something else is going on, you know.
Yeah, I think if there's one takeaway that I adored the most about this movie, it's just how much respect it gives to the viewer. The fact that they lay out A and B, they know that you get that it's C, and they don't ever bother to mention it or go anywhere with it, but instead move on to what are the ramifications of C and how does that affect D, E, and F.
Yeah. Too bad we hated it, guys. Too bad we hated it.
Yeah. I mean, aside from that one completely unrealistic scene that ruined the movie, I would say that this was a science fiction classic.
Yeah. By the way, another great moment was after the fight when they're running out. We don't see Kay flexing his stronger than human muscles at all until that moment when Deckard comes running around the corner and then just plowing through the wall is Kay in there. That was a great eye-opening surprise.
Oh my god. And like, also, Gambling Man points this out. This really deserves to be talked about. The junkyard scene with all the drone strikes while Love is getting a pet or a manicure is so badass, so hardcore. Well, I loved the Love character, and I loved having watched. I don't know how much of this is intentional, but watching the original Blade Runner so close to the new one, the idea, and obviously we see a lot of these echoes of the characters from the first one and these characters in the second one, but Love fighting with the kind of acrobatic sort of fighting style that we saw Priss fight with, but this time kind of more evolved and more violent, was awesome. I loved it.
I'm the better one.
Yeah.
Yeah. I want to read the authorized biography of Wallace.
Oh, like his version, his sanitized version?
Yeah. I want to read the biography of this guy. I want to read about this. I'm like, man, I'm engrossed in this character. I'm like, this is.
Did you guys feel the same kind of confusion in that first scene with Wallace when he murders that replicant that is, you know, he finds wanting for whatever reason? Because at that point, like later, it's like, no, of course he's a bad soulless, you know, wants to create a slave army, whatever. But in that moment, you're like, well, he's an artist who demands perfection, question mark. Like you're giving him the benefit of the doubt, trying to justify why we could get behind this guy who's gouging out the uterus of his newly formed girl replicant.
It was confusing, but I think it's weird that it's not more explicit that he seems to be doing it because she's not fertile or doesn't have a
womb. Because they don't give us any reason for it, and so now we either have to take it on faith that that he's a supreme, you know, Steve Jobsian artist, and this iPhone just wasn't good enough, so he smashed it, or you know, maybe this is a blatant indication that he's not a good guy, and we shouldn't be a fan of him.
I think it's all of the above.
I think this failed, and these things are, it's about. Not the individual, but it's overall the goal of what he's trying to do. You know, he had a lot of good ideas. I'm just going to say that. Okay, here I said it.
Say what you will about Wallace, there were some things he got right.
And also, it shows you why Love feels the kind of the place that she does in the world, right? That like she watches Wallace mutilate replicants, right? To treat them with like you said, like not even objects, just like. Something to perfect their lines of code that he's frustrated that won't compile for him. And yet she is special. She's the best one.
There's also like the interesting little thing, like little subtleties there, which why I want to go watch that again is with Love. Like when she kills Joshi, I think Robin Wright's character, she's like, I'm going to tell him that, you know, that you attacked me or whatever. And you're like, huh, she's going to lie to Wallace, although she's not supposed to be able to lie to Wallace.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's the sort of thing that's sort of kind of like, you know, kind of really interesting and subversive and cool about that. Because the backstory is that there was a Nexus. So you have like the Nexus 8s, whatever, like the Sapper that Bautista was, which had indefinite lifespans. But then there was like the blackout was caused by a replicant uprising, and you know, but then sort of, well, hey, we can't have these. Oh, no, we sort of really need these. But then the idea that they were supposed to not be able to lie, that was the thing about the new ones. They couldn't lie or whatever. They always obeyed, but they don't always obey, you know, which was just an interesting take.
Yeah. So anyway, I'm going to guess our pick is Voltron season 4 coming out next week on Netflix.
Sounds good to me. Lego Ninjago movie.
My pick is get yourself a movie pass and go watch this movie again and again.
Yeah, real quick, thumbs up, thumbs down from those using movie pass.
Thumbs up. Up, 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 up.
Thumbs up.
Yeah.
Especially if you live close to
it. It seems like the only play is that you need to get a movie pass because God knows how long this scheme gigantic burning pile of money will last. Like,
hey, did you enjoy Napster when it was around? Well, why don't you get on Napster now that it's back?
I would pay more for.
Yeah, it's like somebody decided to simulate Napster, but they're going to pay the record companies for every song you download.
Right,
an ethical version.
Gentlemen, again, how lucky are we to have this movie? It's great. I'm glad at least it got made. I hope that they realize the IP has got a tremendous amount of potential in this day and age, where sometimes the best way to do these kinds of stories. Imagine if we had a Game of Thrones movie and to start with. And in the era and time frame when those movies just weren't doing very well.
You know, it's kind of amazing. And this is the last two movies that I've seen were this and Mother, right? And Mother's another movie that we can all see and talk a million years about. But I thought both of these films are the kinds of flicks that people bitch about they don't make anymore because you got to make Thor 7, right? And so I just want the next time it's going to be the price of admission. The next time it's like, ugh, another superhero movie, hot take. You need to show me your stubs for both of these movies that just came out. Like you need to prove that you went to go see these movies because Blade Runner is an amazing flick. And yes, it is a universe that is well known, but man, the kind of movie that they made, I thought was incredible. And Mother, I have no idea how it got made. I have no idea how it's in theaters.
So is that a blind recommendation? Like, just go see it before I hear anything?
If you like Darren Aronofsky, you really, really need to see it. Andrew called me and said, there's a lot of thoughts you can have on this movie, but if you like movies, you kind of have to go see it. It's what Andrew told me and got me into the theater is, you know, there are a lot of frustrating parts to it, but when that movie goes there, oh my God, does it go there? And I've been to the mountaintop, and I can reveal
it's
to you.
The chatter I've heard has been reminiscent of what I heard about Split and Get Out. If both of which those movies, there are moments that I didn't care for, but overall, when it punched hard.
This isn't about a storytelling thing necessarily. It's more. I left the theater saying, I have no idea how this is in a movie theater. How, like, this is insane. Like, how is this not the only thing that people are talking about?
Imagine back in college, your crazy roommate gets really high and tells you this idea for a movie that he had. You're like, that's amazing, man. That's great. And you're thinking to yourself, that's never going to get made. They don't make those kinds of movies.
Right on.
Also, make sure you read the Bible before you go.
the whole thing. Just sit down and get right with God.
Yeah,
no spoilers. Gentlemen, it's been after.
Huzzah.
The Diamond Club hopes you have enjoyed this program.